Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
What you're about to hear is part two on my MIT Enterprise Forum talks on media, technology, and political polarization. How did it come to this part two? And what we're covering in this one is niche media platforms and the fracturing of public discourse. So I got called back to talk about Parler as Parler got shut down. Worth noting that the slides are on the WordPress site, so reconsidermedia.com. You can go there and get those. And the YouTube video of the talk is out there somewhere from MIT Enterprise Forum New York. I'm going to try to post that on the show notes as well. But the deck is really the thing to kind of follow along with. It's a lot of fun. And, you know, finally, those we've got some big patrons recently who I just want to – who haven't given me permission to share their names yet. But I just want to say to those of you who have signed up in the past month, thank you, thank you, thank you. We're doing great stuff with your money. We're staying really busy here. I'm going to have a call with the marketing team soon and make sure that we keep putting it to good use. So in the meantime, enjoy this like mega episode part two, niche media platforms and the fracturing of public discourse.
Wednesday, January 13th in the new year, 2021. And we have our first MIT Enterprise Forum community stream of the year with Eric Fogg, who's joining us from space, as you can see. but we're very excited. He is actually-
Look, there's a time to be off planet. It's now.
Yeah, we'll dive into that. but he is actually our second time interviewee panelist. He's joining us for a second time today, and we're very excited to have him. And for those of you who missed our first round discussion with Eric, it was just before the election in November, and it was very timely to actually have a conversation around media and fragmentation. And now it's, you know, mid-January 2021, we thought the world might be calmer, but it turns out maybe not. So we're excited to have Eric and his experience. It's very timely. We'll dive into that. But before we do, I do want to introduce Eric to our virtual audience. So Eric Fogg is head at Reconsider Media and co-host of the Reconsider podcast and author of Wedged, How You Became a Tool of the Partisan Political Establishment and How to Start Thinking for Yourself Again. Mm. He's been researching and speaking about political polarization and tribalism since 2013, long before it was cool. Very true. Eric has his master's in poli-sci from MIT and spent years working with various NGOs, Harvard, MIT, the UN, and various private advocacy groups. And he is now running a software startup. And interestingly, I found this part of your background most interesting last time, Eric. Eric grew up in a very red part of Pennsylvania and then moved to a very blue part of Massachusetts. And having a foot in both worlds has enabled him to see how both sides of the political spectrum caricature the other and sparked his mission to create real dialogue that cuts through the noise. So again, very, very topical, very timely. Eric, welcome back. We're glad to have you, and I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. I realized before I screen share, I should actually turn my notifications off for a bit. if I remember how to do that. There we go. Do not disturb is on. Okay, cool. Hi everyone. So, which part of Pennsylvania? So from way northeast Bucks County, right by the river. So very much out in the sticks. And actually, this is a good opportunity for me to screen share. So I grew up around a lot of American flags and a few Confederate flags. The Confederate flag folks were actually in their own way, some of the nicest people I knew. Growing up around it, I didn't really understand why it was odd. I've now learned since then why it's odd, but, I've been America is kind of my thing. Some may say my favorite. This is me dressed up as Captain America on the right at Comic-Con. Thinking about how to make the country better is my weird obsession. And so when I went to MIT, I actually tried to become an engineer, and was doing okay at it, but just fell back in love with political science. And so decided to get my bachelor's and master's in that instead, wrote a book, started a podcast. And, like Semi said, I started thinking about political polarization before it was cool. And now, unfortunately, it's now way too cool. And we want to talk a little bit about that. And of course, we were going to talk about just niche media platforms, which is basically we're going to talk about what's Parler and why, and what are the implications of Parler. Now everyone knows a little bit about what's Parler and why, and some of the implications of it. So we're kind of throwing this whole talk for a bit of a loop. And I'm actually going to keep the intro quick because so much has developed so quickly that I want to just get to some Q&A, but I wanted to lay a little bit of foundation. For those of you who came to the last talk, I'm sorry, I'm going to recap some stuff, but I'm going to do it quickly because kind of what I wanted to do was say, where did we leave off the last time we were talking about this and what's changed since then, right? So last time we talked about how polarization in broadcast media is contributing to polarization in the United States and how there's this big feedback loop between those, right? So, there's all sorts of ways where we can see that, it is obvious now that we can choose different online media to tell us the version of the story that we want to hear, and therefore deepen our echo chambers in our own brains. One of the things we talked about last time was how this has happened actually in cycles throughout history. And right now we're in one of these cycles of fracturing where, for example, the main broadcast, old broadcast news is dying and being replaced by more niche news. We already know, so as we talk about this fracturing thing, what we talked about last time is we already know that people are self-selecting, people have been on social media self-selecting out of dialogue with people that they disagree with. It's gotten so bad that even I'm starting to just shut it off because it's just unpleasant. And making sure that the friends that they keep agree with them. During this, what we used to have, this old way of making sure that everyone got a breadth of exposure was through these institutions, these clearinghouses, that in a lot of ways controlled what we could consume, limited our options and made sure that those options were fairly broad. And there were good economic, when you have a small number of actors, there's a good economic incentive to have a pretty broad appeal. And when you have a lot of actors, when you have a lot of actors, because the barrier to entry drops, the economic incentive becomes to become much more niche. So rather than try to have everyone kind of like you a little bit, you get a few people to like you a lot, and you make money that way. And so the cycle we've seen through history is this fracturization as those barriers drop, and then a consolidation. And what I just skipped by here was the fact that on YouTube the barrier is so low, right? You don't even have to have Parler, right? Which required funding, right? You can just take pictures of pyramids and put UFOs by them, and boom, right? You start to look credible just a documentary. And so not only were we able to create media, but we're able to make it look credible. And that gets into people's brains. So the consolidation phase, so the thing we left off on was this consolidation phase is starting to happen again, right? I had figured we were near the end of the expansion of the fracturing phase and beginning the consolidation phase. And the reason consolidation looks like this, this is Birdwatch by Twitter, and it's also Facebook's fact checkers. The reason consolidation looks like this is because the fracturing is actually happening within these platforms, right? So it's, on Facebook, for example, it's algorithms that determine what you get access to. It's not Facebook choosing what to publish the way that the Wall Street Journal does, or Fox News, or Newsmax, or OANN, or whatever. It's just these algorithms. So what does the consolidation mean? The consolidation, at least at the beginning, is tearing down some of what you can be exposed to, and just limiting kind of the Overton window as much as possible, limiting the Overton window as little as possible. And so we ended talking about social media companies starting to like pick off at the edges, at the most extreme, lies, deceptions, violent rhetoric, other stuff that's already illegal to do, but they're cracking down on it more. And so Semi asked me to come today to talk a little bit about, asked me months ago to talk a little bit about the reaction to that. Because what happened was fact-checking became got into the news over the summer, in particular about the Black Lives Matter protests, the riots associated with that, what is Antifa, and misinformation spiked. Some of it got really racist, and there was this decision over at Facebook and Twitter that they had to get more aggressive. They couldn't wait until there were direct threats against individuals to take action. They wanted to start to get ahead of it. Some of this was also just reaction to the president. And the coronavirus. So they recognized that their platform was being used to spread information that was either leading directly to people getting hurt through people, say, for example, choosing not to wear masks, or could lead to people getting hurt through violent action, such as like people, kind of organizing that they're going to go attack some group of people that they don't like. And I'm picking on the right wing a little bit right now, but Facebook and Twitter were also used to organize riots, right? Most Black Lives Matter protests were not riots, but there were people who were like, well, this is a great opportunity to riot, right? And what did they use? They used Facebook and Twitter to organize that. And so as they started cracking down on that, in particular, conservatives got really upset by this because unfortunately, a lot of a large minority of Republicans still believe that the election was stolen, right? So that there are some things that are just like, they believe very deeply that just are nowhere close to true. And so Facebook started fact-checking them and they said, well, we're out of here, right? And so the fracturing that was going on just algorithmically started becoming a platform fracture, where a number of them went and joined Parler. Now, it wasn't that many. It was like 3.5 million at its peak. Parler is not on its own quite as big as a lot of people might think. And I actually think that there were more, if we look back a little bit, like Parler only started to get big in mid-2020 and never really got a chance to become a dominant, a super dominant thread as part of the national conversation. Obviously Parler was used to, it became a right-wing, a extremist right-wing echo chamber, was used to propagate false statements about the election. A lot of violent rhetoric was on it. Planning for the Capitol riot was on it. But it's also the case that hashtag hang Mike Pence was trending on Twitter. Right. So Twitter hadn't fully cracked down. There was still space for that kind of extremist rhetoric on Twitter if you knew how to do it. But Parler did become a powerful place to organize what is eventually what is what is becoming a potentially long-term insurrectionist movement. What was going on before that was 4chan. So if people know QAnon, Q posts on 4chan, and 4chan was kind of like the original place that like the alt-right came out of, and a lot of online Trump support came out of here. Russia used 4chan a lot, in addition to Facebook and Twitter, as part of its misinformation campaigns in all three of our last election cycles, so including 2018, so 16, 18, 20. Someone's going to ask me, why hasn't 4chan been shut down? And I don't have a good answer for you. So I'm just going to say that right now, because it's a disaster. This little logo right here was the Donald subreddit on Reddit, right? So this is part of the intra-platform fractioning or fracturing that happened before the inter, you know, it got shut down, right? So what happened, people fled and they just went somewhere else. And so we ended last time saying the future's a little scary. Now it was because we were actually talking about deepfakes and how hard it is to keep a lid on that. But, you know, I don't mean to be Nostradamus here. The future ended up being even scarier, even faster than I thought. Because we had stuff like this, right? And this person with zip ties is here because, you know, a little bit of sympathy for the devil, I guess. This person who's planning on taking a bunch of congresspeople hostage is here because they believe that, you know, the Democrats and Antifa and communists and dead Hugo Chavez's ghost were all involved in a conspiracy, including within Republican states, to fake election results in order to remove a great president from power, and that a coup has happened, right? So you know, most Americans are talking about this moment being the coup. The folks that are here think the coup has already happened, and that they're fighting against it. And that's the depth of misinformation that they've been dealing with for years, and in particular the months in the latter half of 2020, that led someone to think that their best course of action was to get zip ties, hold some members of Congress hostage, maybe kill them, right? Maybe try to force them to not certify the results. We will find out what's going on in this person's mind, because this person is detained. This person has been arrested, and other zip tie guy has been arrested too. So we're going to learn so much more about what's going on in these people's brains, which would be really fascinating in a morbid way, but I think also really important. Thing that we need to learn, especially those of us in media, to be able to get a better sense of, you know, if we have any sense of civic duty, what are the things that we're doing wrong that help contribute to this? And, so what we're looking at here, everyone knows that this is a watershed moment. I happen to think that this is a watershed moment that is bigger than 9/11 was. I think it's going to more fundamentally change American DNA than 9/11 did. In part because we have to now, you know, the United States has had enemies without forever, right? And if we didn't really have them, we were good at making them up. Now we have enemies within, right? So the state has some clear enemies within. This person is an enemy of the state, right? Literally attacked a building that is, if there is any one building that is the state, it's the Capitol building. So the state now has enemies, meaningful enemies within. Who are planning more violent action. How many of them? Hard to say. But it's also the case that Americans have reached this point where we all believe we have enemies within. And depending on where you sit, who that enemy is different. And so I do think that part of like the interesting conversation at this point is the whack-a-mole game that is about to start. So what we're seeing from Parler having been shut down and Trump having been shut down is that, you know, Twitter and Facebook and even AWS, right, and Azure and Google Cloud, they've realized that like party is over, right? The days of saying, look, we're just the paper. You can't blame us for what people write. Like you can't blame the paper company for what people write on paper. Right? You just can't. You cannot sue the timber company for a book that you don't like, or a book with libel. And that was always the position of these media companies. We're not editorial boards. We are the equivalent of online paper. Those days are gone. And so they're trying to get ahead of it a little bit by taking some action, modifying their policies. In particular, I remember last time someone asked, oh yeah, like what is like Facebook's policy justification for fact checking? And the short version is they didn't have one. It's not a violation of policy to post something that's incorrect. It's why they put a fact check rather than shutting these people down. But you know, stuff like organizing, like planning to take Congress people hostage is an obvious violation. And it's not that they changed their policy about that. It's that they said, okay, we need to get more serious about enforcing it. Because enforcing it turns out is really hard because lots of people use your platform. And what are you going to do? How many fact checkers do you need? How many people are you going to pay to try to police this? What's about to begin is a combination of Silicon Valley trying to get ahead of this Congress racing behind. Like, you know, I know like Congress has a reputation for moving slowly. You will see that, you will see how fast Congress can move over the next few weeks and months in order to try to get ahead of this. And turns out like fearing for your life is a very motivating thing. So Congress is going to be pressing these companies to take further action, to continue to play whack-a-mole. And the reason I'm calling it whack-a-mole is Parler is a great example of why this is a game of whack-a-mole. This is where the talk gets interesting. This is where there's like new content. This is a game of whack-a-mole because when you're everyone uses Twitter and Facebook, right? And so you start fact-checking and you start like kicking people off because they've been violent or because they've like, you know, they're encouraging racism and other things that are violations of your terms. And so what do? They go find some other platform that doesn't have these controls, right? They say like, well, I want to be racist. And Parler doesn't have these controls. We're going to go over here. It was already conservative friendly. It was founded by a conservative, funded by conservatives who believe, and to what extent, you know, are the founders and supporters like just big on free speech, like, you know, I don't agree with what you say, but I'll die to defend your right to say it, versus how much are they, you know, like, hey, what's being said on Parler is great? I don't know. And it kind of doesn't matter because it's sort of just like a law of economics at this point, that if there's a low barrier to entry for people to be able to go build something that makes money, it will happen, right? And it turns out that, web software, and the ability to distribute it has been that low barrier. It's why we had the original fracturization of broadcast media platforms because these barriers dropped, and it's why something like Parler can pop up, and something else like Parler will pop up again. Now, it won't be just like Parler. It will be something new that we didn't anticipate, such as the nature of innovation in a free market. So what's always happening is that like Congress and even Silicon Valley can only close the barn door after a few horses have gotten out. And they'll keep some of those horses in there for a while, but then like basically this analogy is falling apart, but then like a new barn door pops up or something, right? And then it opens. Is there going to be another Parler? Not quite, because they're going to catch it sooner, right? So like the next social media platform that starts to become a place that people are organizing insurrection, they're going to catch sooner, it's going to get shut down. And so what will happen is that the people who really want to do that, who have that impulse, actually will stop looking to apps that are gatekept by Apple and Google, right? Because what's happened, those have become those clearinghouses, right? So like used to be the Wall Street Journal, it's now the effing Apple Store or Apple App Store. That is the clearinghouse for this stuff. So again, that's why I was like, okay, consolidation is happening. But there's enough pressure, I think, this is me speculating. Everything else I'm pretty confident about, this is me speculating. There is enough pressure from all the things that have gone into this. And basically at this point, it's just lies that have gone into this that have made people so mad that they're gonna continue to look for new and creative ways to be able to congregate, discuss, plan. The FBI is going to have a hell of a time over the next 4 years, and so will Silicon Valley and Congress. And that's going to be the whack-a-mole game. We don't know what mole is going to pop up next, is the point. interestingly, so I read this book back at MIT. It was part of one of my master's classes. What's really cool about having gone to MIT was you see this guy on the left, General David H. Petraeus, kind of a big deal. You know, one of like Mattis, he's one of those warrior monks. Steve, his son, was in my class. So we were both 09. So I got to meet the general a few times. And I never quite got to chat with him about counterinsurgency, but like knowing him a little bit, I got to know a little bit about what his thought process is like. And ultimately so why did I bring this up? Because I want to think about the path out, because you can play whack-a-mole all day and the moles will keep popping up. Like that's how the game works. What is the path out? The path out is ultimately a counterinsurgency, which is weird to say, but like here we are, right? And that counterinsurgency, it involves, normally it would just involve propaganda, but the thing about the way broadcast media has changed is that nobody listens to stuff they don't want to listen to anymore. They don't have to, right? Because they have so many options, right? So you turn on the TV and someone's like, hey, maybe Biden won the election. Someone's like, eh, right? Don't want to hear it. So you can't do broadcast propaganda anymore. And so what it actually does is it limits your options. And ultimately, my memory from this, because I did not reread this whole thing because it's like yay thick, but my memory from this is that like the only viable strategy is starvation. And that was the primary strategy attempted by the United States in Afghanistan. It wasn't trying to convert the Taliban, right? Too far gone, they're hopeless, right? And again, they won't listen to us anyway, so what do they care? It was to convert regular people over to the side of the government to deny aid and succor to the Taliban and starve the Taliban. Interestingly, I happen to think that's a pretty good model for how the Ku Klux Klan was turned from a major force in American politics and society into a joke. Similarly, you know, like, again, so my point is, like, we've seen this before, we've seen this work in other places. Starvation seems to be the primary strategy to being able to put down an insurgency in the United States, and just kind of hope that time sorts it out and that the next generation looks back and goes like, those people, like, I don't want to be like them. And that we can all move on to some new terrible crisis. So that's the audiovisual portion of our show today. Sammy and I talked about a few concepts that we might cover, but I guess I took a little longer than I planned, but whatever's on the table, I know some questions popped up as well. Happy to take a shot.
Yeah. Thanks. Thanks, Eric. That was definitely a great recap and good introduction for, you know, everything that's been going on. And I don't know. I hesitate to say anything except the fact that, you know, the pace of everything that's been happening, it just seems more and more frenetic to me, at least personally. You know, I think, you know, given our audience, we also want to touch on a little bit of the role of technology and how these platforms, and as you were referencing, you know, it is becoming an interesting world where if you want to be a content creator, you most certainly can, right? It's almost like anybody with access to a computer and the internet can create their own content, and you know, you will probably get some followers either way. And I think that's an interesting angle to explore too. But yes, we have actually had some audience questions come in already. And so I actually want to start there. So I'm just going to go in order, and thank you all for participating as always. I think our first one is actually more of a comment maybe from Ravi. Thanks, Ravi. Ravi says, we've always had irresponsible media and partisan media. I remember this being referenced on the book American Giant about the Jacksonian era. Isn't this the root of the problem, which has been amplified by social media? And then he posts a link to an Atlantic article, which looks very interesting. I'm sure we can share that.
Yeah.
In fact, but yeah, that's a great comment. What do you think, Eric?
So I wish I had, this was part of my old deck that I dropped that I wish I'd brought up, because there's this great image that we had the last time we covered it of the yellow media, right? It was literally this like devil, like throwing out stuff. Like the media, like print media in the United States probably caused the Spanish-American War, right? And it was one editor who had a financial stake in it that like kicked this off. So, one of the things I want to be clear on is I don't want to imply that like everything was just kind of like hunky-dory forever, right? And then suddenly it got bad. And that was actually like, that was basically the thesis of the last talk, for those who remember, is that we just go in these cycles. To recap, at least my position on this is the consolidation, the most recent consolidation phase peaked in kind of like the 40s and 50s, the Walter Cronkite era, right? Everyone watched Walter Cronkite. It was the era, it was an era of good feelings. It was known as the Great American Consensus. It's not a coincidence that there were three places you could get TV news, right? It's not a coincidence that there were a couple big papers and there was your local paper. Very limited media options. And the consolidation effort that led to that actually was bred by the irresponsibility of yellow journalism. Because what was happening was that basically people got fed up with not being able to trust what they read anymore. So the newspapers that dominated, that came out of this, the Times, the Tribune, the Sun, what they did was they actually voluntarily adopted industry-wide journalistic standards and said, this is how we're going to do things. We're going to commit to it. And they ended up gaining market share that way. And those journalistic standards applied to the ABC, NBC, CBS news networks. But certainly before that, it was a disaster. The kind of like hopeful note in this cycle is that it was like capitalist consumer economic demand for better journalistic standards that drove it. It wasn't government action. Now, to some extent, there was some threat of government action regarding some of the yellow journalism. There were a lot of libel suits. There was also there was some incitement to violence that we're dealing with now, not on this scale, or at least not of this. Other violence in the past has been bigger. It's just not literally been in the U.S. Capitol. So anyway, long story short, is like when Ravi asks, isn't this the root of the problem? It's not the root. It's somewhere down the trunk, but like the root keeps going. Like you can keep digging. What do I think is the root of the problem? I think the root of the problem is like this combination of human psychology and how the dynamic rather than the static way that technology impacts economics or economic incentives. And do I think we're doomed to always have this up and down wave of like consolidation? And, you know, bad angle of it is kind of sense like limitation of the number of perspectives that you can have. This is why people were so excited about the internet, right? They're like, oh my God, we can learn so much about each other and we'll all love each other at the end, right? Those of us who are like older than 30, just like remember how hopeful the internet was, right? And no wonder we're all so cynical because it couldn't have gone worse from that perspective. I think the root is just like there's this like static human psychology and this tendency to economically collapse into a few sources that are like moderated and expose you to a few different points of view, basically close the Overton window, right, for better and worse. And then there's a fracturing which opens the Overton window right back up for better and worse. And is that just going to keep happening forever? Totally.
Yeah. I mean, I think one of the bigger sort of thematic takeaways I'm gaining as I get older too is sort of the cyclical nature of everything. You know, maybe we live through a few different parts of maybe a larger cycle, and this is where we are today. Suffice to say, in my lifetime, I did not think I would experience many things, including a pandemic or, a siege of the Capitol building, but here we are, So yeah, we're in this part of the cycle. So we do have a couple more questions from the audience, and some are, I'm grouping them together if they are thematically similar. The first one, first couple actually, are about censorship, free speech, something that you and I discussed, talking about anyway. So this is a good theme to start off on. So it actually, this one ties back into your first presentation, Eric, but our questioner asks, back in the day when clearinghouses and publishers were being established, were there also a lot of people complaining about censorship as there are today?
Absolutely, right? And a lot of it is, now, and the hard part is like looking back in history, it's hard to get a sense of like what was the true zeitgeist at the time. Mm-hmm. In part because the common man didn't have a platform, right? So like people would be able to look back and say like, oh, you know, like we can even, you know, like think 100 years from now during this age of, during this new age of probably accelerating consolidation, you know, oh, we can even look back and like, we can run a quick algorithm and see like, and just see what portion of the population was complaining about censorship at any given time and goes beep, right? And get a really good pulse on what people think. We actually don't know so much what people thought 100 years ago, right? Which is weird, but it's true. And so, but do we know that a lot of outlets were complaining about censorship? Yes, they were the ones being shut down. Mm-hmm. And so like, and so can you, and so is that actually an indicator that people had a problem, that Americans had a problem with the censorship, or just the people who weren't making money anymore had a problem with it? It's hard to say. Yeah. And I know it's an unsatisfying answer, but it's all we can know, mm-hmm. right? So anything else would just be speculation. However, I know from more recent history, from more recent history, like in the 90s, when like conservative talk show hosts would get kicked off for saying something like, again, it was the 90s, so it had to be like super racist, or you know, inciting violence of some sort, say against, for example, after like Ruby Ridge and Waco, it was Janet Reno. People were talking about doing bad things to her, and these guys would get kicked off. And so, you know, and of course, people complained about censorship then.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Maybe a question I want to answer is, will people always complain about censorship during an age of consolidation? The answer is yes. Now, is like the interesting thing about censorship is, and people who know me really well is I actually kind of lean libertarian. And so believe me when I say, I do not like censorship, right? I super don't. It's a very dangerous power to give the state. Sure. It has to be very, very tightly constrained. Mm-hmm. And I actually see one of Gordon's questions about insurrection. Maybe we can use this as a segue. It has to be very, very tightly constrained, or else it becomes control of thought. Mm-hmm. By the state, right? And the whole point of like why you don't want the state to control thought is like, well, then the people in charge are, you know, get to just reinforce what you think to like them, right? Which of course the president's tried to do for the last 4 years. And so is censorship necessarily bad? It always has some bad, I think. And this is I'm getting into my opinion rather than like reality. I think it always has some bad. But it's been introducing censorship through various means, either through government or through corporations, has been a constant throughout kind of world history. And one of the ways we can think about non-government censorship is just consequences, mm-hmm. right? So we can take away the word, you know, so for example, like Parler getting shut down. It's just consequences and economic incentives, right? So why is AWS so publicly making sure that people know they're not hosting Parler? Because they want to make money, right? And so like the court of public opinion is really ruling. But is that censorship, right? Probably not. Because you know, companies just do the things that are going to make them money. And similarly with the consolidation of better journalistic standards, the government didn't force it, right? Certain companies adopted journalistic standards and more people bought those newspapers and people bought fewer of the other newspapers. So, so is that really censorship? In a way, yes, because the result is that fewer perspectives can get out there.
Yeah.
But is it censorship in the same way that, you know, like the government won't let you say bad things against the government? Like this isn't, you know, we're not talking about like communist China or all sorts of other places where like, oh, like one thing we know is that for all of everything Donald Trump wanted to do, he had absolutely zero power to stop people from saying bad things about him. Yeah. Stop anyone from saying bad things about him, whether it was a regular citizen or someone in his own party or Mike Pence, didn't matter. Right. Everyone can say bad things about him, which I think is like a triumph of our nation. Right. I think it's a great thing that the government's powers and sponsorships are very, very limited. So anyway, that's a much longer answer. The key point being, I want to make sure we're thinking about, we use the word censorship. I'm using the word censorship very broadly. But the sort of like bad form of censorship versus like what is just a shift in the market. And like what consumers want to consume.
Right.
And there's a third thing, which is not just what consumers want to consume, but consumers holding corporations to ethical standards, right? So shutting down Parler is a lot like saying, we're not gonna use coal powered electricity anymore. We're not gonna, you know, buy stuff from suppliers who might have slave labor as part of their supply chain and all sorts of other ethical stuff like that to make sure consumers are happy. That's a like third form of censorship, which is neither. And so all I'll ask is that people like appreciate the nuance of like different forms that this takes place.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a straightforward issue to begin with. There's so many, you know, variables. And I think I'm very interested in this interplay now between, you know, economic incentive, as you say, and basically, you know, what are the people demanding? And in a country like the US where we live, right, basically that wins out, right? Demand. People cater to the demand of the majority. And on one hand, I'm hopeful that the majority of people will demand the quote unquote sane thing. But, you know, I think, again, to echo back to your point earlier about the internet too. Yeah, I think there are many complicated sides to humanity, and we have only probably seen a bit of all of that as it, you know, appears. We've discovered that humanity is maybe not going to hold hands and sing kumbaya all the time. So, okay. So a couple more questions have trickled in. This is great. Thank you all again for your engagement. So I'm going to actually skip around a little bit instead of going strictly in chronological order. There's a lot more questions about censorship, so we might jump back to that topic. But in the meantime, interesting question from Anonymous. Would a solution... And I think they mean solution to all the various problems we've been talking about, but would a solution be a social media platform that charges a fee?
Great question.
Yeah.
I actually want to bolt on one of Gordon's questions too, which is how easy or difficult is it to create a new social media platform such as Parler? Because these sync together really well. So short version is it's trivial to build one. I know a lot of people who could build one in the garage. The hard part is getting adoption.
Right.
Building an app is easy. Getting the app out there is hard. But you know, like many things, if enough people build a Parler, you know, one of them will catch. It's kind of like YouTube videos and other stuff. Like virality is the mechanism here. And like, what's the initial seed? If you like try to build an equation, what's the initial seed for virality? Who knows? But like, once something picks up some steam, if it's got a good coefficient on it, it's gonna whoop. Yep. And that will happen eventually, and the whack-a-mole will continue. And so can you solve this by, and one of the reasons I want to bring that up first is that, can you solve this by building a social media platform that charges a fee? I think the answer is no, for a couple reasons, but I think the biggest reason is that its virality coefficient would be terrible, right? Mm-hmm. Because nobody would want to use it. It's like, oh, I want to, you know, I got to spend, I mean, even if it's $1 a month, right? Consumer behavior in like different contexts is actually really weird. It's one of the hard things about microeconomics is that like there are contexts in which we're like, I will spend $2,000 on this rock, right? That's shiny, but I won't spend $1 a month to have, you know, on The Guardian to make sure I have good news, or news I like, really. So I think the hard part about having a paid social media platform is just that nobody would do it. But let's just say people did do it, would it help? I actually think my first gut impression, totally speculating here, is that if you had a paid social media platform, it would fundamentally limit the number of people who use it and therefore make it a better niche platform. And therefore you're gonna get something that's kind of like an echo chamber. Because like if you got a group of people that are like, we want our own social media platform for ourselves, right? Which happened with Parler, and we're happy to pay for it to keep the riffraff out, then you have an echo chamber. And it might be an elite echo chamber, right? It might be like a bunch of kind of like wealthy Silicon Valley types who are all like, man, aren't we smart, right? And isn't Elon Musk great, right? And all that good stuff. And that'll be their little echo chamber. And are they going to incite rebellion? No. But is it going to be more of an echo chamber problem rather than exposing them to different points of view? And I think that's ultimately the hard part, is I think maybe this is like something fundamental about human psychology. Well, I think it is fundamental about human psychology. Everyone wants to have eaten, to have spent all their life up till now, like working out every day and having eaten broccoli. But nobody wants to work out and eat broccoli today.
Right.
And then similarly, everyone wants a world where we are exposed to different points of view and all this stuff, but nobody's going to do it because it's a different part of the brain that's activated at that time. And we talked about this in the last talk, the type 1 versus type 2 brain, right? That like impulse thing of like, whether you hit like on something, right? You're not going to hit like on the thing you disagree with. You just don't do it, right? And you can't depend on people to do it. You can depend on them not to. And that's the really hard part about how do we get people exposed to stuff that challenges them when our natural inclination is to reject stuff that challenges us.
Yep.
Right. And the context in which we accept stuff that challenges us are either when it's from a trusted source, like my mom. Right. So my mom's like, Eric, you should think about that. Right. Yeah. I'm more likely to think about it. Or when I have to. So when my CEO says, Eric, you should think about that. Well, I have to think about that. So I'm gonna. Uh-huh. But like when some like rando schmo on Facebook says, hey, you know, maybe the election was stolen, you've lost me. Yeah. Right. I don't care what the next sentence is. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm done. Right. And maybe there's something to it, right? Or some other election, maybe there will be something to it, right? But like, you know, my brain is going like, crying wolf again.
Yeah.
And so I will never read the next sentence. I'll just keep scrolling and move on to the next thing. I'll be like, there's a dog dancing, right? Now I'm engaged.
Yeah.
So I think that's the hard part. I don't have a good solution.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, fundamentally we as humans, we like to be comfortable, right? And we like to not feel pain. And so those two things, you know, going hand in hand means that few people, I think, will go out of their way to do those things voluntarily on a regular basis. That being said, I think another interesting question. Actually, I do want to flag one thing. Mark says there are paid social media platforms through Slack. So, you know, it would be interesting to see what the sort of data out of something like that and the usage out of something like that comes out to be. I don't know if you know, Eric, but
no. Well, Slack is free. Slack is free forever if you don't mind 30 days of history being gone or past 30 days of history being gone. I don't know how much Slack has been adopted as a like rando social media thing. What is cool about Slack is that whether using the free or paid version, it's like invite only. Mm-hmm. So your echo chamber is at least deliberately constructed. And most of the echo chambers are good echo chambers. They're companies, yeah. Right? So they're companies who like have a united mission, right? And a goal. And so the big echo chamber is like win, 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 right? Let's work together and do really well. Great, great place to have an echo chamber. So Mark makes a great point. There are there are, it's less about the paid and more about the like exclusivity, the invite only thing. Mm-hmm. But it's certainly not a good way to get exposure to new points of view.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. This is interesting. Can you clarify, Eric, your thesis on the way out of this mess to starve it out? And I think this is something you mentioned in your presentation, but starving it out, the last topic about, you know, insurrections, I think it was, or in,
yeah,
in counterinsurgency. Can you expand on that a little bit more?
Yep. And I just typed an answer to Mark's saying something.
Oh, great.
I don't have a particularly well articulated answer even in my mind. So starving, you know, with the Taliban, what you're actually starving the Taliban for is material resources, mm-hmm, because they have to keep soldiers in the field. Mm-hmm. Right? Those guys got to eat, they need ammo. And so they need money. Where do they get money? They're not the state, right? So what do? They occupy territory and tax people and pretend to be a state. And so you deny them territory, mm-hmm, so that they can't tax people. Mm-hmm. You deny them productive resources, so deny them the poppy fields. Mm-hmm. And you deny them donors, right? By saying, like, don't donate to the Taliban, they're bad, mm-hmm, right? And look at all these people they killed.
Right.
And so if you deny them enough of these material resources, mm-hmm, they starve. They become irrelevant.
Yeah.
And then easily defeated by the army. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, what we ideally want in the United States is not to be in a wartime mentality. There are going to be, like, right now, like, the DC is like going bananas on arresting people. And there will probably be hundreds and hundreds by the time they're done. And that is certainly part of counterinsurgency, is like, the active insurgents have to be contained in some way. So you take the people running around with guns, shooting things, you put them in prison. They can't hurt stuff. But the idea of an insurgency is that there's an ideological driver,
yeah,
that keeps insurgents coming out, right? So you can't, like, you cannot kill your way out of an insurgency, is part of Petraeus's position. And so you have to starve it. So what does starving look like in the United States? We're not actually fighting a war. And as much as, you know, look, I know, like, I don't want to be too hard on people sensationalizing this, but it's not a war yet. And it's not close to a war yet. What it is, you have, like, well, I mean, what it is, it's insurrection. There was an insurrection, and you now have a lot of people who have checked out of the system, right? Don't believe in the democratic system anymore. They don't believe elections are secure. And so their position is, actually, I remember I've said this before, and I'm now starting to eat my words, but I've said the following. There are four boxes to use in the defense of liberty. Mm-hmm. Soap, ballot, jury, ammo, using that order, okay, right? And all of us gun nuts have had this fantasy that, like, oh, the time guns come into play against the government is when the government becomes a tyranny and the people, as this united block, the people rise up. Right. And the reason this fantasy is wrong isn't that, like, I know a lot of people, like, there's no way the American people can defeat the U.S. Army. It's like, look, dude, if the Vietnamese and the Afghanis could do it, we have a lot more people, we could do it. Right. So if the American people were united against the federal government, the federal government wouldn't stand a chance. Right. It'd just be very one sided. So there's a different reason it's a fantasy. The reason it's a fantasy is the American people will never be united, right? This is what we've learned, is like everyone agrees there's a coup going on, but everyone disagrees on who's launching the coup.
Yeah.
And so that's the hard part. So you have, so how do you starve the group of extremists who are contemplating, who have reached the point where they think, you know, along this line of boxes, that ammo box is the last one they have left because their liberty is at stake because Donald Trump totally won the election. How do you starve them? That's obviously the group you have to go after. The way you starve them is, I think, the same way that the KKK was starved. Mm-hmm. So you take everyone who's not there, mm-hmm, and you get credible, trusted sources to say that they're crazy, or that the president is bad, right? So I think, for example, one way to starve the insurrection would be for, like, you know, Sassy and Murkowski and Graham and Romney and McConnell to get together, get enough Republicans to vote to convict the president, and convict the president. And what's going to happen is you're going to have a lot of people that go like, holy freaking smokes. This is serious. In a way that like they're enabling of him in the past, and they're kind of like brushing off his comments, right? In the past, fueled the insurrection. Having credible sources, you know, having the number of people who support this position, the number of like public voices who support this position shrink and shrink and shrink, is a way to starve the insurrection, because the people that were going after are the ones that believe the election was stolen but are not taking up arms. They've not gone that far yet. And so let's say that like through the right kind of messaging from these trusted sources, Fox News, you know, Mitch McConnell, etc., the number of voices saying, look, this is crazy town, has just become overwhelming. You get normal conservatives to say, you know what, Biden actually won, and Trump probably shouldn't have sent a mob at the Capitol to try to kill Mike Pence. And the starvation comes through social pressure. Mm-hmm. So when it is like uncouth to do something, people stop doing it real fast, right? So like this applies to haircuts.
Okay.
Right. Like people will not wear a haircut that is uncouth. Okay. Or like if I wore a KKK patch through San Francisco, I would fear for my life.
Yeah.
but even if I didn't, I would just get heckled and screamed at all the time. Sure. And I would be like, okay, not going to do that. Right. I might even believe it, but okay, not going to do that. Now, of course, there's been a lot of attempts by liberals to shame conservatives and it backfires. Mm-hmm. What conservatives need is conservatives shaming conservatives. Again, people that they trust, people that they look up to,
right,
shaming them. And they're going to have this moment of like, oh man, maybe I shouldn't. And so, you know, the way that starvation pattern happens is trusted leaders shame normal conservatives shame kind of the radicals, and everyone who's on the fence, yeah. Right? So when someone like on social media is like, I'm going to storm the Capitol. Like if all of his friends go like, what is wrong with you, you idiot? Right? Like what a lame yee thing to do. Yeah. They're less likely to do it rather than their friend group stoking their fantasy. And that's exactly, I know this is a long explanation, but that's the point of starvation. It's starving people's, like starving their motivation, starving their social reinforcement.
Yeah. Yeah. I definitely as a brain and cog sci major back in the day, I think, you know, from a psychological perspective, yeah, getting to people's motivations and why they do certain things, I think that's a pretty powerful reinforcer of whatever kinds of behaviors manifest, right? So, yeah, definitely an interesting point. And perhaps we can make insurrection uncool again, or, you know, exactly. whatever it may be. But yeah, I agree with you. I think that network effect too of, you know, reinforcing certain ideas or not is definitely powerful. So we are already in our last few minutes, but I do want to bring up one last question that maybe—
I'll keep my answer quick this time.
Oh yeah, no, we love it, Eric. Yeah, no, if people can stay on, you know, we'll keep it going for a little bit past.
I can't.
Okay, yeah. So because we have a hard stop, last thought on maybe having it wrap all together. Mm. Danielle says, what are your thoughts on documentation? So how social media platforms overlap with documentation of government statements and how they are archived. So maybe let's make it a little bit broader and say, is there any, you know, can you see any benefit possibly to having some of this history of the, let's say, crazy statements documented on a public platform? Is that a good thing? Is it a bad thing to take it away? What do you think?
Sure. Absolutely guarantee there are archives of everything posted on social media all the time. The people with those archives are the NSA and the FBI. Mm. So it's there. Mm. And it can be used as evidence against you. So everyone who posted on Parler, like, I'm going to storm the Capitol, right? Like that will cut, you know, like there's going to be a prosecutor who holds that up. It's like, remember the part where you said you're going to storm the Capitol and capture Nancy Pelosi and then you tried? You're toast, right? Now, in terms of, so that stuff is backed up. I'm almost certain that like news organizations such as the Washington Post have probably archived all of President Trump's tweets as well. Mm-hmm. And so in terms of archives for research, is it going to be out there if it's important? Almost certainly, right? Is anyone in charge of that enough to guarantee it? No. but is it going to be out there? Almost certainly. Because it's a trivial thing. It's a trivial like one-line script and like floppy disk to contain the text that is President Trump's tweets. So don't worry about that. In terms of like kind of public record for, you know, for changing kind of mass opinion, I happen to think it doesn't matter. Again, because like nobody is going to, it's like eating like turbo broccoli, right? Nobody's going to go like, I need to be educated on everything Donald Trump said and I don't like him, right? The people who really like him, they've already read all of his tweets.
Yeah.
Them reading again, is it going to help? Probably not. But the people who don't like Donald Trump, like they're not going to eat broccoli to the level of going like, I am going to read everything Donald Trump said in order to be able to better be able to understand my fellow American who thinks that the election has been stolen. So I think from that perspective, unfortunately, it's irrelevant. Just again, because of the same human psychology, like the part of our brain that interfaces with social media is so, it's the elephant rather than the rider, right? So I happen to think it's going to be irrelevant. I've got to run, but I want to invite everyone who's still on the line, please go to the Facebook or LinkedIn post with this. And there were some great questions that we didn't get to because I am super verbose. Please, if you want them answered, please at me. So at Eric Fogg, E-R-I-K space F-O-G-G, on the LinkedIn, you know, in a thread on the LinkedIn and the Facebook post. And I will reply sometime in the next few days. To your question, because some of these are super good. I'm bummed we didn't get to them. And I'd love to, you know, you'd be able to pin me on public record about a few things as well.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Eric. Thank you everybody for your engagement. This was fantastic. We may have to do a part three. We'll see where we go from here. But Eric, as always, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolute ball.
And yeah, and thank you all for your time and have a great night, everyone. Thank you.
Yes, have a great night. Stay safe, wear a mask, and don't commit insurrection, it'll bite you in the butt.
Yeah, exactly. All right. Bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
When your skin feels nourished and glows, you radiate confidence. Osea makes giving your skin a glow-up easy with their clean, clinically proven Mega Moisture Duo. This seaweed-powered duo features two of Osea's best sellers, Undaria Algae Body Oil and Undaria Collagen Body Lotion. Glow from the inside out. Get 10% off your first order with code GLOW at OseaMalibu.com. That's OseaMalibu.com, code GLOW.